Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the hour. Today is the third Monday of Picun's Day Without an Immigrant campaign. Once a month, Piñeros y Campesinos Unidos Noroeste calls on all immigrants across the state not to shop and not to go to work or school in order to demonstrate their economic contributions and how closely they are woven into our social fabric. In support of their campaign, our first segment this morning is about the history of U.S. citizenship and the ways citizenship has been repeatedly contested over the centuries. Lori Mercier speaks with legal scholar Amanda Frost, author of the book, You Are Not American, Citizenship Stripping from Dred Scott to the Dreamers. Following that, book mole Matt Witt discusses the novel Low April Sun by Constance E. Squires, which examines the aftermath of the white supremacist bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City 30 years ago. We'll close our show with another book mole, Norm Diamond, who reviews two highly political books written for a middle school readership. Silenced Voices by Pablo León is a graphic novel on the struggle by indigenous people in Guatemala and their immigrant experience in the U.S. Shift Happens by J. Albert Mann is a labor history of the U.S. beginning with Columbus. Norm draws on the books to examine what teachers might mean by teaching truth. I'd like to remind you that KBOO is a reliable source of news and information and support for the left community in Portland. Please, if you can, support the work we do. You can contribute by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or simply mailing us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Now, here is Lori Mercier with Professor Amanda Frost about the history of who is granted citizenship in this country and who loses it. Hint, it is nearly always people of color whose citizenship rights are contested.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Amanda Frost, the David Massey Professor of Law and Director of the Immigration, Migration, and Human Rights Program at the University of Virginia School of Law. In addition to numerous law review articles about immigration and citizenship, she has published in The Atlantic, The New York Times, Slate, The American Prospect, and many other publications. She's author of the recent book, You Are Not American, Citizenship Stripping from Dred Scott to the Dreamers. Welcome to KBOO, Professor Frost.
Thank you for having me.
Well, today, in response to the brutal ICE raids terrorizing many American cities, we often hear people claim this is not who we are. But much of your work looks at how citizenship has always been at risk and contested, and how individuals and groups of people, just like we see today, push back against restrictions and that kind of policing. Can you say something about that trajectory, perhaps beginning with the 1850s Dred Scott case and the 1868 14th Amendment?
Yes, and this is a cycle that I chronicle in the book you mentioned, You Are Not American. It's not been an unrelenting story of attempting to deny or strip citizenship. I really want to emphasize that. It's been cyclical. The story really begins in the antebellum era, where we had a constitution drafted in 1787 that did not define citizenship. And citizenship was contested throughout that antebellum era because there were open questions about whether free Black people were citizens. Most people thought slaves, of course, were not citizens since they had no rights at all. And then what about Native Americans? What about the rights attached to citizenship for women? These were all open questions. And In 1857, the Supreme Court decided Dred Scott versus Sanford, in which Chief Justice Taney spent about half his opinion addressing this question of citizenship. And he was incensed about the idea that any Black person, slave or free, could be a citizen. He said that was not constitutionally permissible. And in fact, he went even further. He suggested nobody of an inferior or subordinate class could be a citizen. And we know from his other jurisprudence that for him, that would have included certainly all people from various countries in Asia could not be citizens. And he also suggested only Christians could be citizens. So for Chief Justice Taney and people who thought like him, very few people could be considered part of we, the people, for whom the Constitution was drafted and who belonged and had a role in the United States of America. And of course, we then fought a civil war over slavery that was precipitated in part by the Dred Scott decision. And then in 1865, we emerged from that. Slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. There were over 4 million free Black people. There were immigrants arriving in large numbers. We were a nation of immigrants. And there was an open question of who counted as an American, who could be a citizen. And that was the question that was addressed by the Reconstruction Congress in 1866.
Well, how did the rejection of Dred Scott, which the 14th Amendment ingraining citizenship to all Black people eliminated, and the institution of birthright citizenship usher in new debates about who should be allowed into the United States?
Yeah, so the Reconstruction Congress, emerging from that Civil War in 1866, they knew that they not only had to abolish slavery, but they also had to abolish the caste system that accompanied racialized slavery. And they recognized that we were a nation of immigrants, with immigrants arriving daily, particularly the Chinese on the West Coast, who at that time had become the vilified immigrant group. And they recognized that all of these individuals needed to be incorporated into the United States of America as equal citizens. So they did a couple things. The first, in the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the Reconstruction Congress added as a first sentence birthright citizenship for just about everybody. And I think it's particularly interesting that Senator Lyman Trumbull, who proposed the language that created universal birthright citizenship, that is, all persons born were in the US were citizens with narrow exceptions, but Lyman Trumbull first put it in terms of race. I think he said all persons of African descent are citizens. And then he rethought it, and very shortly thereafter said, no, wait, just all persons born are citizens. And in part, that's because I think he recognized that he was responding to Dred Scott and the problem of racialized slavery, which of course was first and foremost. But not only them, the goal was also to grant citizenship to everyone else, including, as I've mentioned, the children of Chinese immigrants arriving in the United States daily. And then, following that legislation, Congress added to the proposed draft of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution what is the Citizenship Clause, that's the shorthand for it, that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And that provision, which became that first sentence of the 14th Amendment and is now in our Constitution, created near universal birthright citizenship. Now, you'll notice from what I just quoted that you have to be born and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So, what did they mean by that? Well, the Reconstruction Congress explained who they wanted to exclude. It was these very narrow groups of people that had also been excluded under the English common law. That's the children of diplomats. That was one narrow exception. The other narrow exception was for children of invading occupying armies, which happily we haven't seen in the US for a long time. And then the last group that the Reconstruction Congress carved out from universal birthright citizenship were the children born within Native American tribes. And this is the provision they debated at greatest length. Today there's now a statute that grants birthright citizenship to children born within Native American tribes. But at the time, those tribes were viewed as separate sovereign nations, and that it would be actually antithetical to their sovereignty to grant children automatic citizenship at birth born within those tribes. But everyone else, they made clear, were birthright citizens, including the children of immigrants, and particularly the children of Chinese immigrants, that question came up, and they answered that affirmatively yes.
Well, despite that kind of universality of birthright citizenship, certainly by the late 19th century with the Chinese Exclusion Act and then later exclusionary immigration policies tried to limit who could even be in the United States and claim that citizenship. And you've noted that 90% of citizenship stripping and immigration restrictions have been based on race. Can you just cite some examples of that kind of racialized exclusion?
Yeah, our immigration and citizenship policies as a nation have always been shot through with racial animus and racial discrimination, and that has been the primary locus of battles over citizenship and immigration. Not the sole source of debate or conflict, I should say. Women lost their citizenship for the first few decades of the 20th century if they married non-citizens, even native-born U.S. women. Another example of a non-race-based loss of citizenship includes people whose speech or conduct, particularly if they were affiliated with a communist party, led to them being denaturalized. So it wasn't solely about race, but significantly about race. So to deal like, to address again the Reconstruction Congress and its debate over this, it knew, of course, that racialized slavery would lead to, even at the end of racialized slavery, a caste system based on race. They could see that the reaction to Chinese immigration was, of course, racist. And that's why they created universal birthright citizenship. Shortly thereafter, of course, the Reconstruction Congress fell out of power. At that point, the Democratic Party, which was the party of Johnson and the party of that embraced racial discrimination in various ways, shapes, and forms, took power. And they put in place the Chinese Exclusion Act. And this was in response to anti-Chinese animus on the West Coast, which had seen both a rise in Chinese immigration and an economic downturn that resulted in legislation restricting Chinese immigration. And of course, we saw after that restrictions in the 1920s that barred almost all Asians from immigrating to the United States, barred almost all people from Africa from immigrating to the United States, and significantly restricted immigrants from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, who were also viewed in racialized terms and rejected as Americans.
And those policies were changed in the 1960s as a result of civil rights movements and Americans pushing back on those kinds of racist restrictions. So I think your book also really emphasizes the pushback and among individuals and groups of people who have always resisted these kinds of restrictions.
Yeah, and that's one thing, that's a point I tried to make in the book, which is while there's certainly a through line here of racist policies seeking to exclude, there's equally a through line of people fighting back. Of course, the targeted individuals and groups themselves, in particular, I have to say, Chinese immigrants and their descendants were enormously successful litigants who fought back in every way, shape, and form, including in the courts, and often won their cases. Women who lost their citizenship fought back first in the courts and then in Congress. And of course, by getting the right to vote in the 1920s, that was enormously helpful to successfully encouraging and lobbying Congress to end the restrictions on their citizenship. As I mentioned before, US citizen women who married non-citizen men for several decades automatically lost their citizenship. So we see lots of examples of the targeted groups fighting back and also other Americans stepping up to represent and help them. So while the story certainly has its dark side, I think it's also important to acknowledge how often people responded by saying, no, that's what it means to be an American is that you're here and you're born here. It is not about race or lineage or ancestry.
Well, let's talk about what is new and not new about Trump's immigration policies. What is the Trump administration attempting that is novel? Are they going further than some of these anti-immigration forces of the past have gone?
Well, I'll focus in my answer on the birthright citizenship litigation, which is now currently pending in the US Supreme Court. And first, we'll go back in time a little bit. We already talked about Chinese exclusion and anti-Chinese animus. So, in addition to the Chinese Exclusion Act, which barred Chinese immigrants in the 1880s from coming to the United States or laborers, in addition, the US government decided that it was going to try to challenge birthright citizenship for the children of Chinese immigrants. It viewed that automatic citizenship that the Constitution guaranteed to children of Chinese immigrants as a loophole in the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the US government brought a case before the US Supreme Court, United States versus Wong Kim Ark, and they challenged Wong Kim Ark's citizenship. Wong Kim Ark had been born to Chinese immigrants. He'd lived in the United States most of his life. He was American at birth, and he knew it. But the government argued that no, he wasn't, and they tried to interpret the Constitution, or they argued the Constitution should be interpreted to exclude the children of all immigrants from being citizens. And I've looked at the correspondence. It's clear they were targeting the children of Chinese immigrants, but these government officials couldn't find a way to read the citizenship clause in our Constitution in the race-based way it wanted. So instead, it had to take this fairly sweeping position that would have unwound the citizenship of thousands of people, if not tens or hundreds of thousands, in the United States. It was actually a close case. It was not clear the government was going to lose, but it did lose 6-2 after more than a year of deliberation in the Supreme Court. That was back in 1898. Since then, we have a pretty much unbroken tradition of agreeing as a nation that we have a guarantee of universal birthright citizenship, a constitutional right that ensures that, of course, the newly freed slaves were integrated into the United States, but also that the children of immigrants are integrated into the United States. And in fact, that's something the United States does extremely well. The children of immigrants flourish. They are more than half the leaders of Fortune 500 companies. They are a part of our reason we're an economic powerhouse. And that brings us to January 20th, 2025, when President Trump took office. He had mentioned in his first term he wanted to end birthright citizenship. And indeed, he did it day one. He signed an executive order arguing that the citizenship clause has been misinterpreted for more than a century now, and that in fact it excludes children of two groups that have always been granted citizenship. One is the children of undocumented immigrants, and the other is children of temporary immigrants. Now, that doesn't just mean children born to tourists. That also means children born to student visa holders, people on H-1B visas, which are skilled workers. It includes people who've been here for many years. It includes people who are applying for green cards while living in the United States, which is very typical, right? Someone might come, get a PhD in the United States under a student visa, maybe start working under an H-1B visa, maybe get married to a US citizen or get an employer to sponsor them, and then they apply for a green card. And so it's quite common that someone who's on a temporary visa has been here for years and is fully integrated. And yet, according to the Trump administration, these people's children are born without US citizenship and possibly stateless, and certainly could be deported on day one of their lives. So this is the argument the Trump administration is making in the US Supreme Court. They've made it in the lower courts and lost in every court, including in front of judges appointed by Republican presidents. And now we're going to see what the Supreme Court says about it this spring.
Just the implementation of that seems kind of unimaginable, how children born in the country, how people would determine who belongs, who should be kicked out. How do you do that with babies? It just seems really pretty far-fetched.
Yeah, and one point I always try to point out to people is over 3 million, I think it's about 3.5 million children are born in the United States every year. So under the Trump administration's interpretation of the citizenship clause, the estimates are about 230,000 children would be born going forward who would not be citizens under the Trump administration's view. So that's 230,000 new unauthorized immigrants every year because they wouldn't have status, who are at risk of being deported, creating a brand new problem that we don't have, right? But in addition to that, everyone else, doesn't matter whether your ancestors have been here since the Mayflower, every single person who has a child will now have to demonstrate their ancestry, their lineage, their immigration or citizenship status to the satisfaction of the US government before their child will be considered a citizen. Children, sometimes these newborns need medical care, and again, they wouldn't qualify for any kind of government support or government aid for that medical care unless they can first prove their child is a citizen, again, requiring this kind of paperwork and proof. And it would be hard enough right now, but if this goes into effect, conceivably, if your grandparent or your great grandparent was either came to the US without permission or was a temporary immigrant when your ancestor was born, then you aren't a citizen and your child isn't a citizen. The argument would unwind the citizenship of a nation, of immigrants, which is what we are. And for that reason, it seems like antithetical to everything the Reconstruction Congress wanted to accomplish and would create chaos for not just children of immigrants, but children of all individuals living in the United States.
Well, it's clearly a policy of white supremacy, and we've seen that over and over again with how ICE has been policing certain kinds of immigrants based on color of their skin and accents, and the rapid admission of white South Africans. So this kind of racism that at times has peppered U.S. history and its immigration and citizenship policies has now been emphasized by the Trump administration. And just as birthright citizenship has been upheld over a century, naturalization and the naturalization process is another long time or long held affirmation of American citizenship that seems to be under attack in the Trump administration. Can you say something about some of these attacks on the naturalization process?
Yeah, just to give a little history, in 1790s, the United States enacted a naturalization law, and that law allowed for fairly lenient naturalization, that is, the acquiring of citizenship by those who were immigrants who were born non-citizens. But it was only for free white persons. That's the language in the statute. So you had to be white to be allowed to be a citizen or to become a citizen. And then, of course, we added this birthright citizenship clause to the Constitution in 1868 at a moment of in which the Reconstruction era, the Reconstruction Congress, was seeking to end these kinds of race-based exclusionary rules and laws and practices. But when it came to updating the naturalization law in 1870, Congress balked. It didn't do it. It added that you could become a citizen if you were of African descent, you could naturalize, and still you could do so if you were white, but no one else could, which is just bizarre. And for the next 40 years, there was debate in the courts who counted as white. And they had such difficulty defining and determining who was white. So Asians would attempt to naturalize, Arabs, all of these groups. And there was this debate, were they white? Were they not? Could they naturalize? It was farcical and would be funny, except of course it was tragic. And actually, I have to say, I think World War II and Hitler kind of helped the United States see the errors of its ways. And it wasn't until 1943, in the middle of that war, that the United States amended the naturalization laws to allow Chinese immigrants to naturalize. Of course, Japanese immigrants had also been barred from naturalizing, and your listeners may be familiar with the Japanese internment that occurred during World War II, when people of Japanese descent, whether they were immigrants or native-born US citizens of Japanese descent, they were rounded up and imprisoned. Again, applying these racist assumptions about who could or could not be a loyal American. Happily, we ended that shameful era. The last racial restriction on naturalization was ended in 1952. And today, anyone can naturalize of any race. However, what we've seen under the Trump administration is an effort to ramp up denaturalization, that is, taking away citizenship from people who acquired it through the naturalization process. The government tried to do this during the Cold War era based on people's political beliefs and membership in the Communist Party, et cetera. Eventually, the Supreme Court ended that practice in a case called Afrin versus Rusk in 1967. And they said, look, you really can never take away citizenship, with the exception if there's some sort of fraud or error in granting citizenship. The Trump administration, though, certainly in the first Trump administration, tried to take advantage of this by very aggressively pursuing denaturalization, even of people for whom there'd been minor errors or inadvertent mistakes in the naturalization process. It was investigating about 700,000 naturalized citizens to see whether there'd been a flaw or error in their process. And it was trying to ramp it up. It didn't succeed. There were not the thousands of cases they might have wanted to bring. And there's been talk about ramping up denaturalization again in under Trump too. Again, so far, it has not succeeded. We're not seeing hundreds or thousands of cases being brought, but it's out there as a risk.
Well, this has all been very illuminating, Professor Amanda Frost. You've given us a primer of the history of citizenship and citizenship stripping. So thanks so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel.
That was a spot of music called Clandestino by Manu Chao. Before that, you heard Laurie Mercier speaking with Amanda Frost about the history of American citizenship. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now, for our listeners, here's something you can do to resist the forces of white nationalism. As the Epstein files reveal, the global billionaire class has been raping, ripping off, impoverishing, surveilling, and bombing citizens around the world for decades. And Oregon taxpayers are helping to fund this cabal. The Oregon State Treasury manages over $148 billion in assets, primarily focused on the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund, which is one of the nation's largest pension funds. Oregon investments include, as just one example, $3.6 million in Palantir Technologies, which has supplied ICE with data analytics and AI platforms. Palantir also has ties to the Israeli military and has been implicated in Israel's draconian surveillance of Palestinians. But you can make your voice heard by urging Oregon Treasurer Elizabeth Steiner to align Oregon's investments with the human rights values of Oregonians and require that state investments comply with international law on human rights. The next Oregon Investment Council meeting is on March 4th. You can submit written testimony by Wednesday noon, February 25th, by going to the OIC website. Simply Google Testimony Oregon Investment Council. The right-wing violence currently perpetrated by ICE is nothing new in this country. Bookmole Matt Witt reviews the novel Low April Sun by Constance E. Squires, which explores the complex psychological scars of survivors of the white supremacist bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City 30 years ago.
2025 marked the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City that killed 168 people, including 19 children in the building's daycare center, and injured at least 850 more. 2025 also marked the publication of Low April Sun, a novel by Constance Squires that is set against the backdrop of the Oklahoma City bombing. Squires is interested in the continuing mystery about how many people may have been involved in planning and carrying out the bombing. Like most mass murders in the United States, the attack in Oklahoma City was the work of white supremacists. Three men, including Gulf War veteran Timothy McVeigh, were convicted for their roles. But the help they may have received from a larger network has never been fully investigated. The author of Low April Sun is also interested in how the legacy of a mass murder radiates outward like ripples on a pond, leaving psychological scars long after the event itself. Edith, one of the main characters in this novel, is dealing with a number of major life issues. Her half-sister had business at the federal building the day of the bombing, and Edith has never gotten over it. Edith's husband, Keith, was once her half-sister's lover and has an addiction to gambling, an addiction that gaming companies are only too eager to exploit. And Edith is the communications director for a major oil company that profits from large-scale fracking, a process for extracting oil and gas from inside the earth. Edith knows that fracking and oil companies' wastewater disposal practices have caused a significant increase in earthquakes in Oklahoma and other states. But her boss wants her to lie to the public and claim that the link between corporate profiteering and earthquake danger has not been proven. Eventually, Edith meets a recovering alcoholic named August, who was raised in a white supremacist compound about 3 hours' drive from Oklahoma City. August, it turns out, was unknowingly drawn into the bombing plot as an accomplice and has never told anyone what he knows. Turning everyone's lives upside down 20 years after the bombing, Edith and Keith receive a Facebook friend request from someone purporting to be Edith's half-sister. Is it spam? Or is she alive after all? And if so, how could that be? And what would that mean? I won't tell you more, so as not to spoil the story for you. Suffice to say, Squires is a very observant author who does a great job of creating characters and describing their thoughts and feelings. She also perceptively explores questions about obsession, guilt, personal integrity, and forgiveness. The Oklahoma City bombing remains the deadliest act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history. But as Squires points out, it has largely faded from national consciousness, perhaps because of the identity of the perpetrators. It will not fade from the memory of those who were directly affected, however, and this suspenseful novel, Low April Sun, brings to life a few of the many stories that American atrocities like this leave behind. It will not fade from the memory of those who were directly affected, however, and this suspenseful novel, Low April Sun, brings to life a few of the many stories that American atrocities like this leave behind.
That was Matt Witt with his review of Low April Sun. What we used to think of as facts are now highly contested in this country. But as Norm Diamond points out, the relationship between facts and truth can be even more complex and contentious. Norm reviews two books written for middle schoolers in his commentary on what it means to teach the truth. Here's Norm.
Good morning, Old Mole listeners. This is Norm Diamond, acting as your book mole today. I'm going to do something a bit unusual in the course of this morning's program, review two books that are related only in that they are political and written, both of them, for middle school readers. Let me repeat that. For our sophisticated Old Mole listeners, I'm going to call your attention to two books geared to 12-year-olds. One of the books is a graphic novel relating the experience of Guatemalan immigrants in the U.S. now to the decades-long struggle of indigenous people in Guatemala that culminated in peace accords in the mid-1990s, but that, in fact, continues in less military forms today. The other is a book-length history of working people in the United States starting with Columbus's arrival. Both books were sent to me to evaluate by terrific teacher organizations with which I'm proud to associate, Teaching for Change and the Zinn Education Project, develop and provide classroom materials, offer workshops for teachers on how to teach Black history, the Palestinian struggle, and many other important and controversial topics, and offer scholarships and training for outstanding teachers toward working with others in their schools and communities in developing new curricula and classroom materials. The Zen Education Project is a joint effort with Rethinking Schools, an outstanding quarterly journal in which teachers write in depth about their experiences, for instance, working with transgender students, or resisting efforts by right-wing groups to censor their classrooms, or using poetry to enable students to examine their own lives or bring students from different backgrounds together. The three organizations, Teaching for Change, Zen Education Project, and Rethinking Schools, together reach about 200,000 teachers nationally, with many participants throughout Oregon and Washington, and annual conferences between our two states that draw hundreds. The first book, Silenced Voices, by Pablo León, is powerful and a delight. I recommend it without reservation to interested adults as well as high school and middle school students. As I mentioned, it's a graphic novel, and it uses that form effectively to tell an important and moving story. The story's frame is the experience of two Guatemalan indigenous schoolboys living in the United States, whose mother has never told them much about how and why they came to be living here. That silence is common among immigrant families. My grandparents, too, never talked about their life in the old country. The younger boy is prompted to question that silence, even though ridiculed by his older brother, who initially doesn't understand the importance of his heritage. The older brother's perspective will change as he learns from his younger sibling. Much of the story is told through the experience of their mother as a young girl, what happens to her, her family and friends, the destruction of their village by Guatemalan government forces, her difficult flight, and how she ends up here. In the early 1980s, with Guatemala under military rule, more than 400 villages of people of Mayan ancestry were obliterated by military attack, with tens of thousands killed and hundreds of thousands forced into internal exile or escape abroad. The mother's story is one of danger, horrors, and remarkable resilience. I read Silenced Voices nearly at one setting. Having worked with Guatemalan groups during the time the story is set, I approached the book with a kind of implicit checklist. For example, would it mention the United States' role in the repression? The Israeli role, which was large? Would it have a credible account of the guerrilla movement in opposition to the military and Guatemalan elite? While these aren't major themes in the novel, they are present and handled fairly. As I said, I was moved by the story. The only thing I thought the author got wrong was his one-sentence assertion that the resistance movement won in the 1990s. In fact, winning and losing are often ambiguous in real life. My sense is that the movement's participation in negotiations in the mid-1990s and in the ineffective truth and reconciliation process was rather a result of the movement's weakness. But I thought it fine to end the book with that sense of hope rather than ambiguous defeat. But that misrepresentation raises the significant question of what we mean by truth, especially when teachers using these books in the classroom are subject to so many pressures to teach a sanitized, mythologized version of history. Is it enough of a response to teach, quote, what really happened? And what do we mean anyway by what really happened? When we return to look at the second book written for middle schoolers, Shift Happens by J. Albert Mann, different understandings of truth and what we should mean by that word will be one of our points of emphasis.
Con cabellos largos, huipiles blancos, bajo la noche de luna nueva creciente y llena menguante. Ella se mostró. Algunos por los pueblos la ven caminar, han visto su rostro, cicatrizado está. Hay quienes le temen, le creen sobrenatural, pero su historia les quiero contar.
That was La Ciguanaba by Guatemalan indigenous artist Sara Curuchich, whose work features indigenous rights and struggles in Guatemala. We now return to Norm Diamond's commentary.
Hi again. I'm reviewing two books that I was asked to evaluate for their possible use in middle school classes. The first, Silenced Voices, by Pablo León, was a graphic novel that began with the experience of Guatemalan immigrants in the U.S., but traced that present experience to the political struggles of older generations back in their homeland. The second book is an ambitious labor history of the United States, Shift Happens, by J. Albert Mann. Before turning to its specifics, I want to note how remarkable I find its intention, teaching the story of work and workers to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. Do children of that age have the ability to understand complex social and political issues? Until recently, that capacity was in doubt. In fact, I once debated Herbert Marcuse, icon of the 1960s radical movement, on precisely that question. The setting was the living room of a mutual friend, and Marcuse was being dismissive of working politically with anyone younger than college students. I challenged him, not out of any experience I had, but just out of logic. He argued what the psychology of that time claimed, that children grew their understanding of the world in enlarging concentric circles. First, the child's world was restricted to the mother's breast, then the immediate family, the neighborhood, the community, etc. And only by college age could young adults have much grasp of the larger world and its forces. My response was that psychology was flawed by being restricted to the empirical. Psychologists were testing children for what they understood now, but neither they nor the education system were attempting to push the accepted boundaries. We couldn't know children's potential, the limits of their capabilities, I argued, until we had actually tried to expand those limits. I think I won the debate on logical grounds, but it's teachers and students across the country, very much including the groups that sent me the books to review, that have turned that potential that once was hidden into what's now empirical reality. It no longer surprises us that students of high school age or younger can take stands against racism, or in protection of the environment, or in support of immigrant classmates. And that issue of potential as its own form of reality brings us back to the theme with which we ended part one of these Old Mole reviews this morning. Beyond, quote, what actually happened, potential, too, is an aspect of what we mean by truth. Shift Happens has a lot of qualities that make it suitable for youngsters. Short chapters, lively accounts, good use of illustrative anecdotes. Whether the language is appropriate, it uses words I can't say on the air, like the vaguely scatological reference in the book's title, I leave to others closer to that age group. Politically, it has important strengths. It explicitly relates past history to present challenges. Its understanding of labor history casts a wider net that is true in many other books on the subject. For example, linking U.S. military attacks on the Russian Revolution in its early days with government attacks on worker movements here, or correctly treating the U.S. Electoral College as a weapon against workers as part of class struggle. It shows how arguments used by capital now recycle the same motifs from the past. It identifies capitalism as the underlying problem throughout. There are also, however, problems with the book, including some things it gets plain wrong. The AFL was not a union, but a federation of unions, an unfortunately common mistake by people outside the labor movement, but one that bespeaks unfamiliarity with the author's subject. Her one-sentence reference to the great and formative West Coast longshore strike in 1934 dismisses it as a loss. This is an egregious dismissal of a victory that both shaped Portland and had national resonance. Apparently, she's not read my own co-authored The Power in Our Hands, which has an entire unit on that strike. She says Muhammad Ali served 3 years in jail for draft resistance. In fact, he was sentenced, but served not a day. More subtly, that is, not exactly wrong, but wrong in a way that has vast importance, her account of the so-called timber wars here in the Pacific Northwest and Northern California presents that particular labor environmental struggle as a straightforward loss for the environmentalists. Having been part of that struggle, my emphasis would be on how the labor environmental movement grew as a result, even as the trees ended up clear-cut, how it brought some workers and environmentalists closer together, enlarging the perspectives of both, how it forced protective legislation, not simply a loss. Teachers are under a great deal of pressure now to impose a distorted and idealized version of U.S. history, one that departs from the facts. But facts are contentious. Interpretations differ, as we've seen even with this working-class sympathetic text. When we return with part three of this morning's book reviews, I want to delve more deeply into this labor history for middle schools and what we mean by truth and teaching truth.
In the year 2002, with only 20 minutes warning, the liberals introduced Bill 29. Only 3 days later, that hateful bill was passed. It offered BC workers bitter wine. The layoffs and the closings took their toll on patient care, with loyal workers laid off and locked out. With our collective bargaining rights denied by act of law, our union's very future was in doubt. But we fought back, we fought back, we fought back and we won.
That was a clip from the song We Fought Back by Rebel Voices. Now, here's the final part of Norm Diamond's commentary on teaching truth.
Back again for the third and final part of this morning's Book Mole Reviews. Part one was about a well-done graphic novel on the struggle of Mayan people in Guatemala, especially in the 1980s, and its relation to their immigration to the U.S. now. Part two began a review of Shift Happens, a labor history for middle schoolers by J. Albert Mann. We left off with the meaning of truth when it comes to teaching history. An important element of what teachers mean by teaching truth is teaching how to understand a society. We look at history not only for inspiration or to validate our sense of grievance, but also to learn things like how to figure out who might be potential allies in our present struggles, and how to assess strengths and weaknesses in the structures that maintain what we want to change. One strength of Shift Happens is its inclusive sense of who workers are, including farmers, slaves, artisans, etc. A serious weakness in the book is its repeated generalizations that group the entire class as if there weren't and aren't differences of perspective or differences in perceived interests within the class. The author has U.S. workers as a whole sympathizing with the Russian Revolution. According to her, U.S. workers knew about and understood U.S. trade policies. The poor understood the myths they were being fed, etc. Similar generalizations about undifferentiated groups within the class, for instance, about white worker radicalism, implying all white workers, obscure important distinctions and forego opportunities to teach strategic analysis. Perhaps as a result, her chapter on the post-World War II Treaty of Detroit between the Auto Workers Union and the Big Three auto companies misses the crucial point that the so-called treaty marked a shift in the union from a class-wide perspective to advocacy for UAW union members alone. Similarly, her detailed account of the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act leaves out what may be its most important consequence, that the legislation bans sympathy strikes, bans the most meaningful solidarity actions one union can take on behalf of another. When the author does offer explanations, as distinct from simply narrating events, they are often too simplistic. Her objective seems more to shock students out of complacency, a good but limited goal, rather than to teach ways of thinking and modes of analysis. She explains the development of wage labor, for instance, by a single factor, that it is cheaper for economic elites to pay wages than it would be to house and feed people they've enslaved. This indeed was and is a factor, but hardly the only one. Another factor a teacher might consider mentioning in this context, of course, is that enslaved people can be harder to control, have a long history of resisting. Shift Happens treats democracy throughout as an unproblematic concept, as if what is called by that name in our country is the only form conceivable. The author treats Communist Party organizers in the labor movement fairly, but she accepts the anti-communist slur that equates communism as a vision for the future with what happened only in the Soviet Union. She does this through her definition of communism strictly and narrowly as state control of the economy. By contrast, consider Karl Marx on the vision of a transformed society, not simply an economy, in which the state as an institution has withered away. You know that quote about the state withering. There are unreconciled emphases throughout the book. On the one hand, the author shows lots of resistance, even revolts by workers. On the other hand, the overall tone is one of victimization. As a result, I was not left with a convincing sense of hope. As with her account of the timber wars, a more nuanced understanding of activism, both its costs and how to measure success, is called for. She does offer a more balanced assessment of one form of activism, strikes in workplaces, both encouraging the tactic by showing multiple historic wins and simultaneously cautioning about the price paid by strike participants. Similarly, the understanding of the state which she presents is not coherent. Often she portrays it as nothing more than an agent of the ruling class, seeming to discourage making demands on it. But other times, she recounts successful working class pressures on the state and even advocates for participation in electoral politics. Here, too, a nuanced summation of what she thinks we've learned from the history would have been useful for students considering activism. It also might have prevented other egregious and misleading history mistakes, like treating the right of California agricultural workers to organize as nothing more than a gift from the governor. Gaining that right was, of course, very much also an outcome of workers' willingness to defy the law that banned organizing, and organize in spite of the law's prohibitions. Along the same lines, she is inconsistent in drawing lessons about whether working-class movements should aim at stricter regulations on capital or at getting rid of capital entirely. At various points, she implies both. This is a set of issues that teachers could use to highlight dilemmas we face in attempting to be actors in history and to model a more strategic level of thinking. Tougher regulations, for instance, might actually reinforce capital and enable it to persist, as happened with the New Deal. Conversely, it might be possible to organize, and should be possible actually, to organize for greater regulation now, but to do so in a way that builds a movement toward abolishing capital entirely. There's a difference, of course, between what a book offers in itself and what a prepared teacher might bring to it, a difference between the text's limitations and how a creative teacher might transcend them. I've tried to suggest that we need to go well beyond the notion of truth as limited to accuracy about what really happened, what really occurred. In other words, what happened empirically. Potential is equally a form of reality and can be analyzed and understood. From that perspective, we learn that thoughtful strategy could have made a difference at crucial points in history. We, as well as students, can see that the society we have now was not inevitable and that it could develop in different directions in the future. We can draw on history to learn how to analyze our own society, how to understand its potential for change, and see the alternative paths it offers. Most of all, we can see that the alternatives can be influenced by our present actions. I've been talking about two books written for middle schoolers that are worth our attention as adults: Silenced Voices by Pablo León and Shift Happens by J. Albert Mann. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That does it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Laurie Mercier, Norm Diamond, and Matt Witt for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest, Amanda Frost. A shout-out to the staff at KABU, who keep the gears turning. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. I'm going to leave you this morning with a song called Resistance Bells by Seth Staten Watkins, a song inspired by the fierce resistance in Minneapolis to ICE.
Just another day for the Hell Brigade, another party for the Reaper. They say deny your eyes, well, it's comply or die. All hail the glorious leader. The banshees cry.